Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Toro. Top-notch custom fit technology helps Tour Pros feather and iron to a tight front pin. Now using the technology on Toro's new Greensmaster Flex Series Walk Greens mower, superintendents can dial in that same exceptional, precise level of operator performance on even the most contoured greens. The Greensmaster's bale feathering feature let the operator slow down or speed up by putting more or less pressure on the bale and stay hands-on even through the tightest turns. The melding of operator and machine continues with the telescoping handle that ensures perfect harmony between the mower and operator, tall or short, and the handle's rubber mounts have just enough cushion to prevent any hand movements from influencing the cut. For putting surfaces so pure, they'll make a Tour Pro tip their cap. Trust the Toro Greensmaster. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Today's episode is with Chevy Chase Country Club's Director of Grounds, Stephen Britton. Stephen's one of my favorite people in the turf industry. He is into golf history, professional golf, golf course architecture. Really, he is a golf tragic. He came over from Australia. Really interesting story. So without further ado, here is Stephen Britton.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Was Royal Melbourne the first of the great Australian courses you played growing up?
No. So I actually grew up about a mile from the front gates of Peninsula Kingswood. You know, back then it was called Peninsula Country Club. It was always a good golf course, 36 holes there. And it's amazing now, Mike Cocking redid both the golf courses. It's really good. But I grew up about a mile from that golf course. I used to pick balls there on the range after high school. And we would get to play there as an employee. I used to pick balls on the range and clean clubs in the bag room and worked in the pro shop every now and then. And so we were allowed to play and practice there. So that was probably the first good golf course I played. I grew up playing golf at a public golf course down the street from Peninsula. It was right next to the city dump. If the wind blew, the whole golf course smelled like rubbish the whole day. It was covered in seagulls. All you'd ever hear is the reverse buzzes of the dozers pushing the rubbish over. But it was great. It was $300 for unlimited golf for 12 months. And so I used to play there. And then when I was working at Peninsula, you know, I could, as an employee, get to play there a little bit. So that would have been the first good golf course that I played. And then as I got a little bit better, we joined a private club, which is on the same road, but next door to Peninsula, called Long Island. And that's a good sandbelt golf course. It was really good. So they was that those kind of those courses in that Frankston area, they would have been the first ones I saw.
That's sounds a lot like my growing up in golf. Our junior membership I think was $300. I'd play all I wanted, except for like Saturday Sunday mornings were like the restrictions. And then you know, I'd play at Knollwood when I had playing privileges just from working it, and it was. That was the way to do it. But it was so nice the days you get to play the country club, you know, versus the Muni.
Oh, yeah. Like, I remember, so the Muni had Poa greens and the country club had bent grass greens then. And I remember going and playing Peninsula and, like, mate of mine that was working there that kind of got me the job on the range. I remember him telling me, like, hey, these are bent grass greens, really different than what we've been putting on, and they were firmer and faster and smoother. I remember thinking, like, oh, I feel like I can hold every putt on these. Like, I never, that was the first time I kind of ever knew the difference between Poa and Bentgrass. I just figured they were all greens before then.
I feel like when you're a kid too, when you know you're learning the game, when you switch to those fast greens, and then you go to the, it's such a huge adjustment when you're a kid. Like you can't get your bearings right on the speed of putts. That's something I just remember. Like when I played fast greens, I'd have so much trouble. Then I'd go back to the mini, I'd have trouble getting them to the hole.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. They were the best days though. That the muni course that I grew up at had tons of kids my age, and we just spent every day there. We'd play every day after school, and we'd play skins games, and like after school it was quiet, and like seven of us, we'd play like a group of seven and play skins for balls and stuff like that. And they were the best days playing golf back then. It was tons of fun. But
when did you start working grounds at Royal Melbourne?
Okay, so when I finished high school, I loved golf. I was obsessed with golf then. I was playing golf a lot. And so I knew I wanted to work in golf, but I wasn't ever going to be good enough to do, you know, be a club pro or anything like that, or work in a pro shop. And so I just kind of decided I wanted to be a greenskeeper. And so that was 1994. And so that was like before the internet and emails. I think people were probably emailing then. I wasn't. And I sent, I wrote letters. I mailed them to the 10 best clubs in Melbourne. Like I picked, you know, Royal Melbourne, Victoria, Kingston Heath, Metropolitan, Woodlands, Yarra Yarra, Huntingdale, all those. And I just wrote this letter. I can't even remember what it said, but it said, you know, I'm a junior golfer and I want to be a greenskeeper, and I was looking for an apprenticeship. So they do schooling really different in Melbourne than America. There, you get hired as an apprentice after high school, and the club employs you as a full-time employee, and you kind of go to school 1 week every month. Like, so you'd work 3 weeks and then you'd go to school for a week. And you do that for 4 years. And then after that, you're like a fully qualified greenskeeper.
I kind of like that model.
It was the best system. Yeah, it was great. I wish something like that was over here. Maybe there is, but it's really different here. Like my guys that work for me who have gone to college here, you know, greenskeeping is just like one class they take. They're taking all these other classes that they have to do. And then they just do a summer internship for 90 days and that's kind of it. But yeah, we would work and go to school, and it was the best way to do it. And the club pays for that. Like when you're hired as an apprentice, they pay your tuition to go to school. And so you're making money because you're working, but the club covers your tuition. So as dumb luck would have it, out of those 10 letters, Royal Melbourne, Jim Porter was the superintendent of Royal Melbourne. He was like the fourth superintendent in the club's history. And he got back to me and said, hey, we're looking for an apprentice. Do you want to come in? And he put me on like a 3-month trial. It was just luck, right? Like that happened to be the right place at the right time. And he put me on a trial and he hired me as an apprentice. So a lot of clubs would hire like one apprentice every 4 years, right? Like when you finish your apprenticeship, they'd start to look for another one. Mm-hmm. And so I was that guy at Royal Melbourne. I didn't even have a driver's license. My mum drove me to the job interview. Like I think I was 17. I'd just finished high school. And so I worked there for 8 years. It was great. It was a
so after you did the apprenticeship, you worked for 4 more years?
No, you do your apprenticeship for 4 years, and then most clubs you stay on and you're a fully qualified greenskeeper. So that's your full-time job then, right?
Yeah, so after the apprenticeship, you did 4 more years there.
Oh, yes, you're right, yeah. So I actually did an apprenticeship and then I did more schooling. I did a diploma class. So the way to think of that in American terms is think of it as like a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree. So the apprenticeship would be thought of as probably a 2-year degree, And then if you do extra schooling, the diploma course, that would be your bachelor's. That would be the four-year degree. So I did that after my apprenticeship, which was one night a week for two or three years now. And it was every Wednesday night from like 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 9 o'clock at night. So you're still working, but you would go and do that class in the evenings.
How were your role, like when you started, I assume you were doing all the grunt stuff, but by the time you're at the end of the 8 years, what type of stuff were you doing for the club and the grounds crew?
Yeah, so when you start out, you're filling tea divots and raking bunkers and you don't really get to mow a lot. And then, but as time goes on, they say, hey, you know, today we're going to teach you how to mow green, and, you know, we're going to teach you to mow fairways. And then you'd work your way all the way up until you were spraying, because spraying is quite a important thing, obviously. And it's, you put your best guys on that. So yeah, by the end, you're the one spraying greens, and especially if you're hosting tournaments, which we did at Royal Melbourne, like that, when you're spraying greens kind of the week before the tournament, that can be nerve wracking, right?
Yeah. Didn't Tiger play in that time frame down there? Or was that at Kingston Heath that he played in that, like, maybe late 90s?
So when I worked there, we had the Greg Norman Holden Classic. That was a tournament that Norman had on the Australasian PGA Tour. And then we had the 98 President's Cup, which I was there for. And then we had a couple of Heinekens after that, which were kind of European tour, Australasian tour events. Mm-hmm. So it was an exciting time. There was an exciting time to work there, especially with the President's Cup. That was the first time the President's Cup had come to Australia. It's the only one we've ever won, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was an exciting time to work at the club. It was great.
What do you look back on? I mean, you were 17 years old through 24. I assume your interest in architecture probably peaked at a later age. You might have been generally interested in it, but what do you look back on and think about when now, like, I know you go back to Australia and you've been back to Royal Melbourne a bunch of times, but like, what are things that you overlooked about Royal Melbourne that you now look at as, you know, a head superintendent, somebody that's been in the industry for a couple decades?
If you grow up in Melbourne and you're playing those courses, and I know lots of the guys from Melbourne say this, and especially the good players that come over to America, like you kind of think that that's how all the courses look, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because back then in the 90s on TV, like, we didn't have cable TV back then. And so you'd only get to see the Masters, and you wouldn't see week to week PGA Tour events in America. So I just remember thinking, like, this is what all golf courses were, and this is how they're all mown. But when you leave there, I think you realize how great it is, right? And how everything we did there was great. The way we managed the water, we never overwatered, and we were always really lean with the water. And the way they mowed the golf course, I remember thinking, like, mowing everything to the bunkers and, you know, mowing short grass all the way to the bunkers around the greens, I remember just thinking that was normal. And when I first came to, and then when I came to America, you see all the bunkers and the rough, and there's rough all the way around the greens, and you start to realize, like, oh, geez, we do it really different in Melbourne than to everybody else.
How's Melbourne evolved since you worked on it in early 2000s to like what we saw in the President's Cup? How has it evolved in its maintenance practices, or is it pretty much the same? Has the course changed at all?
So, like, architecturally, it hasn't changed. I think they've done some stuff right since when I was there. They didn't really change anything. Agronomically, I think it's changed quite a bit, because so when I worked there, we had on the fairways, we would have what they called a two grass system. So in the wintertime, all this native poa would come up in the fairways, and the fairways would just turn into poa fairways. And then at the end of the winter, the poa would fizzle out and die off. Sometimes we'd spray it out. Sometimes we'd just let it fizzle away. And then all this native Bermuda grass, couch grass, would come up, and the fairways would be Bermuda fairways in the summer. And it was, I think it was unique to Royal Melbourne. I can't remember if all the sandbelt clubs had that years ago, but when I was at Royal Melbourne, that's how it was. You had poa fairways in the winter and Bermuda fairways in the summer. And so that they got away from that over time, because I think, you know, that's a tough transition, to transition out from poa to Bermuda, and you get some bare spots coming into the summer. And, you know, it doesn't get that cold in Melbourne. You can have good Bermuda fairways in the winter. So they got away from that at some point, which is probably a good thing, because it means the fairways are better year round. And so now the greens surrounds now are fine fescue around the greens, which when I was there, they were actually mostly poa around the greens and some bent grass. And the fine fescue that Richard Forsyth's the superintendent there now that he's put in, they're amazing. I mean, they're firm and
fast.
Oh yeah. I mean, great to chip off of, the best lies. And with the fine fescue, he can spray certain herbicides to keep the poa out, which will stop the poa getting in the greens, which is really important there.
Oh, that's interesting. So that fescue surround, because of the way you can spray it, actually it creates like almost like a buffer for the poa.
Right. They'll have a program where they'll spray certain herbicides the fine fescue is quite tolerant to some of these herbicides that will help keep the poa out of that fine fescue. So that helps out. Whereas when I was there, it was poa all around the greens. And so it was hard to keep poa from getting into the greens.
Would that work in like the Midwest? Like say Chicago? Cause I know like one of the, you know, poa getting into the greens is something common here. And I'm just, you know,
I don't know. Like, but I mean, he's mowing, everything there is mown low, and so you'd have to do the same thing. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. But it works there because there's no poa on that golf course at all at Royal Melbourne.
I think that might work at Cal Club too, right? Cal Club does that.
So, yeah, that's really similar program. Yep, everything's fine fescue, right? Fine fescue fairways at Cal Club. Mm-hmm. Everything around the greens is fine fescue, so they have a really good program there to keep it out. So yeah, that's a good point. It's really similar to their setup. When I was there, the greens on the non-composite course, okay, they were the original, what they were called, Sutton's greens that Mick Morecambe seeded when they did the renovation with Alistair McKenzie and Alex Russell. And then the composite course greens were actually Pencross, so American bent grass that they'd converted, I think, sometimes in the 80s. I'm not too sure. And the superintendent that I worked for, the club had decided that they were going to try to put the Sutton's greens back, which was hard to do because they don't know what grass that is, right? Sutton's was a seed company in England that in the 20s, golf courses in America and around the world would buy just greens grass seed from this company in England, and that's what you seeded your greens to. And I don't think they never knew exactly what was in the mix. So those greens had segregated out to the parent plant. So those greens at certain times of the year would have purple patches and dark green patches and light green patches. And so they took samples out of each one of those different patches, and a company in New Zealand grew the grass and got them to set seed. I don't really know the whole process, but they came up with the closest thing they could imagine to the original seed mix.
So they recreated it.
They recreated it. That's what Jim started, the superintendent that I worked for. And so in my first year, we sod cut the 12th East Green, which was the smallest green on the golf course, and we seeded it to that seed mix and kind of replicated what those greens were seeded to in the 20s. And so it was a really exciting time. We ended up doing the whole golf course to that, and that's what they have today.
Yeah, you know, last week we saw Wingfoot, and I think one of the neatest things about that restoration was how that they preserve the grass from the greens, like the poa, and they didn't go with that brand new, like they, you know, they basically use the same grass, and in Royal Melbourne's case, just figuring out a way to recreate the seed to get that same grass.
Right. Yeah. So that all happened when I was there, which was really great to be around, and it's turned out great today. The greens of Royal Melbourne are unbelievable. I think all year, like not just for the tournaments, they're great every day.
When did you leave Australia, and why? Why'd you leave Australia? Well, you're rising superstar at Royal Melbourne. What got you out of the country?
So in 2000, we had the 98 President's Cup at Royal Melbourne, and in 2000 they had the President's Cup over here in Virginia at Robert Trent Jones Golf Club. And I can't remember the exact connection, but there was a connection between the two clubs a little bit, and there was an opportunity for a couple of us from Royal Melbourne to come over and work that event. Myself and another guy on the staff at the time, we came over to work the 2000 President's Cup at Robert Trent Jones. And so at the time, well, still there now today, Scott Furlong was the superintendent, and Glenn Smickley, who's now general manager at Cow Club, he was the general manager at Robert Trent Jones. And I came over and we all kind of hit it off and became friends, and we stayed in touch, and I went back to Royal Melbourne, and, you know, not a lot would change at Royal Melbourne back then. Like I said, Jim was like the fourth superintendent in the club's history, and the assistant had been there for a long time. And in 2003, Scott contacted me and said, "Hey, we have an assistant position opened up at Robert Trent Jones. Would you be interested in coming over and being an assistant here?" And it was the best thing for me because, you know, I loved working at Royal Melbourne. It was great. But I, you know, I probably needed to grow up a little bit. I was a little immature. And so packing my bags and coming to America and taking on an assistant position was, in hindsight, the best thing for me. And it kind of made me get a little more serious about things. And they had the 2005 President's Cup kind of locked in. So I thought, wow, this is a good opportunity to come over and see what America's about. And also I'll be an assistant superintendent for the 2005 President's Cup. So it sounds like cliche, but I packed two bags and emptied my bank account, which wasn't much, and moved over. And then the club helped me get a visa. So I came over on Mike O'Keefe's Ohio State program on his J-1 visa, and then the club helped to get me a longer visa to stay for 6 years, and that was it. Yeah,
that club's probably got some, you know, they can pull the strings on the visas easier than a lot of clubs.
Yeah, they have those kind of people, that's for sure. Yep.
So you move halfway across the world, and you move. I was it more jarring moving from Melbourne to America and getting used to the American lifestyle, or moving from growing grass at Royal Melbourne to growing grass in the Mid-Atlantic?
Well, I know. I'd been away once already. I took a year off from Royal Melbourne to go to the UK, and I worked at Wimbledon at the All England Tennis Club. So I worked at the tennis club and looked after grass tennis courts for almost a year at Wimbledon. So I'd been away from home.
How'd you get that job?
The same thing. A guy at Royal Melbourne knew somebody who was at Wimbledon, and they were looking for kind of seasonal greenskeepers. And I got approached and said, "Hey, is this something you'd want to do?" And my dad's British, and so my dad's whole side of the family live in England. And again, I was obsessed with golf, and I'd become interested in golf course architecture, right? That was when, you know, I was kind of one of those early guys on Golf Club Atlas, and I was looking at Golf Club Atlas 4 days a week. And so you start to learn about all these great clubs over there. And I thought, geez, this would be a good opportunity to go work at Wimbledon, but while I'm there, I can go and see Sunningdale and Woking and Walton Heath and, you know, and go up to St Andrews and try to visit golf courses as well. And so that's what I did. I went over, I worked there in, so I went over there before the President's Cup at Robert Trent Jones. So I was there for the 2000 Wimbledon Championships. We had the Davis Cup that year as well. So we did the 2000 Championships, and then we had the Davis Cup right after that. And it was great. It was great to learn another side of greenskeeping on tennis courts. And
talk about what, how's it different? Like, how do you maintain a grass tennis court differently than a golf course? Obviously they're both playing surfaces. Is there similarities and differences?
I mean, so they're kind of mown a little bit lower than what I would say is a tee height, right? Like, but tennis courts, you're trying to get them rock hard. I mean, we would mow them with the same mowers we'd mow a golf course green with. But then we would roll the courts with like a road, like an asphalt steamroller, you know? And so we would try to get them rock hard. There's not a lot of turf other than the courts at Wimbledon. Like, the whole place is cement, you know, and then there's these grass courts. They've clay courts for the members. It's a members club, right? The All England Club, ever membership. And there's indoor courts in the wintertime, and they have croquet courts as well. And then they have the championship court. So, but it was great. I got to work there for the year and tried to visit as many golf clubs as I could. That was kind of what I was more interested in, to be honest with you. I went up to St Andrews. And
one quick question, how much firmer, like if I hit a golf shot on a Wimbledon grass court, would it just like bounce forever?
Yeah. I mean, they crack out, right? The baselines after a few days in the tournament, they're cracking open. Like, there's cracks in them where you can see, you know, a few inches down. So, oh yeah, they're rock hard. Yeah, their ball, you'd never stop it. They'd bounce off the court.
Interesting. And then the grass stays alive and everything. So that's just the end of the spectrum of how firm you could get turf.
Yeah. I mean, the baselines struggle at the, you know, by the end of the 2 weeks, they're usually pretty beat up because that's why they're running back and forth. But it was funny that at the time, so the superintendent at Wimbledon at the time was a man named Eddie Seawood, who'd been there forever. He was kind of like a legend in tennis court maintenance in England. He was a really, really great guy, really old school, wore a shirt and tie to work, you know, wore a tie to work every day. And geez, he was just really good at it. But their seed mix, I remember asking them what seed they would use back then. It was a secret. They had kind of blended their own and they didn't really want anyone to know. But it was a good place. But like I said, I was kind of more interested in visiting golf courses and playing golf over there. And I went to St Andrews right after the 2000 British Open. And I didn't get to play, though, because it was so busy then, because the British Open had just finished. All the stands were still up and they were just packed. But I caught the train up after work and spent the weekend up there. And I think I walked the course like 10 times and took photos. I went up there by myself and just spent the weekend at St Andrews by myself just to see the old course. And it was a good time.
What was your, you know, you're at this point early 20s and you're getting into architecture. What were your, like, what did you learn over there that you didn't really understand having just played in Australia, which in Melbourne, which is obviously one of the great golf cities too?
I remember thinking, like, some of the Heath courses in London, they were a bit like Melbourne, you know, like, because they have Heath between the tee. Like, a lot of clubs in Melbourne will have Heath from the tee to the beginning of the fairway, and a lot of the courses there would as well. I remember thinking, like, geez, I was surprised how similar some of them were to Melbourne. And the old course, I remember walking around that. I wasn't playing, and so it's really hard to try to figure out what's what. I remember walking it for the first time and not even knowing which way holes were going and where greens were, and because you can just walk around it. There was like a seashell path that went around the whole golf course, and I just used to walk around that over and over, and I'd walk out into the holes when there was no play and no groups. And But that, so that was really good. We're really different to America. But yeah, so I'd been away for a year. So coming to America wasn't as daunting because I'd already been gone once. But yeah, really different. Like of all the places I could have chosen to come and work in America, the Mid-Atlantic and the DC area is, I didn't know at the time how hard it was to grow grass here because it's really hot in the summer and, you know, you're only growing cool season grasses. And then greenskeeping was really, and that was really different than back home. That was the biggest learning curve, way different.
Was there a early mess up? You do something that you just killed a bunch of grass because you just didn't know that it was going to get the way it was going to get, like so hot and humid or something?
No, because, I mean, so when I went to Robert Trent Jones, I mean, big staff, high expectations. So I was one of four assistant superintendents. And so, you know, you're like the entry level guy and mm-hmm. the three older guys kind of say, hey, this is how we do it. And this is how you keep it alive. And you just, so you kind of learn, right? Like you learn through being there every day and being around those guys.
Cause that's in the summer, that's what it's about. It's like just keeping it alive, right? That's like number one, as opposed to, you know, I imagine it's so much different than Royal Melbourne or even England.
Yeah. I mean, it gets hot in Melbourne, but it gets cool at night. And that's the difference here. It gets hot here and it stays hot during the night. And it's so humid here. I mean, yeah, July 4th to Labor Day here, it's hold on to what you got and just try to get to the fall. That's kind of the rule of thumb that everyone in this area goes by, because if it gets wet in the summertime and we start to get those storms, and the worst is when you get a downpour in the afternoon and then the sun comes back out and it's blazing hot. That's when everyone's kind of white knuckled and really worried. Wet summers in DC are when people have a lot of problems.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor. For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as tour pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer support from Toro and its dedicated local distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today. Now back to Stephen Britton. You talked about how greenskeeping was so much different just the generally here, and getting that was a huge adjustment. In what ways was it different than Australia?
I mean, so like all the obvious stuff you could probably think of, right? Like we didn't do anything to rough in Melbourne. We didn't water the rough and we didn't even mow it that much. But it's a really different golf course. In Melbourne, they were on sand and native roughs. And so you hit your ball in the sand, you hit your ball in the rough, and you could be in bare sand or you could be in grass. And you never really know. But over here, the roughs are perfect, and fertilize the rough and spray the rough and water the rough. And the rough gets mown two or three times a week. And that was different. I remember thinking, geez, spending as much time in the rough as we are in fairways. And I just wasn't used to that. In Melbourne, you didn't even look at the, you know, we didn't think about the rough. So that, you know, that was a surprise. And this, the level of greenskeeping was, the expectations are so much higher than what it was back then. I mean, it was I think greenskeeping in general, like in the mid-90s, I think golfers' expectations, not just like pro golf, are so much higher now than they were 20 years ago, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think Royal Melbourne back in the 90s, I think we only raked the bunkers twice a week. I don't remember hearing any complaints about the bunkers back then. And, you know, I don't know how often they rake them now, but I mean, at Robert Trent Jones, we raked the bunkers every day. And, you know, it was almost like a tournament set up every day, it felt like.
If some members had it their way, you'd probably rake them in the middle of the day too.
Yeah, I bet there's some courses out there that do that. A bit. So that was really different. That took some getting used to, just the different maintenance expectations and the different way they looked at things. And
drastically different style of golf too. Like, I mean, RTJ, I haven't been out there, but I've looked at it. I mean, extremely aerial versus Royal Melbourne, extremely ground oriented. About as polar opposite as you could get.
Yeah, no, like I remember, they don't do it anymore, but we used to rake the bunkers all the way up to the face, which I think a lot of courses in America were doing back then. And, you know, in Melbourne, we would keep all the faces smooth. We never would rake them, and we wanted them to be rock hard and don't touch them. And even some moss, or you get like a crusty kind of layer growing on, getting on the sand. And we wanted that because we wanted the balls to roll back down. And I remember thinking, like, geez, it's funny, they rake up the face. I didn't think you'd want that. Like, and it wasn't just that club. Like, that was the kind of the American way to rake bunkers back then, was they just raked everything from edge to edge and all over. I remember coming and thinking, I wonder why they do that. Like, I wouldn't think you'd want to do that. And then so it was when I got my first superintendent's job, I went back a little bit. I said, you know, I'm not going to rake the face. We're going to keep the faces smooth, and we're just going to rake the bottom.
Where was that job at, the first superintendent's job? Was that TPC Potomac?
No, it was at a Tom Fazio design golf course right down the street from Robert Trent Jones, which was great for me because I, you know, the superintendent, Scott at Robert Trent Jones, I was right down the street, so I could borrow equipment, or I could, that was the greatest place for me to start because the expectations weren't as high and I could make some mistakes and it wasn't as much of a catastrophe as it could be at some other clubs. And so I could kind of play around with things, and in some ways they let me kind of do whatever I wanted there. I could change grassing lines, and I even added some bent grass around some greens to make it a little bit more like home, because there were just some swales where I said, I'm going to take the rough out and put bent grass in here to make a little chipping area. And so I could play around at that place as much as I wanted. It was tons of fun. It was the perfect place for my first superintendent's job, because I could try to figure my own way out. And if I made a mistake, it wasn't such a big deal. And I had the guys at Robert Trent Jones right down the street. So
yeah, that's a big part of, I feel like, superintendents and the culture is where, you know, if you work for somebody, or, you know, you have somebody that works for you and they get a job, then it almost becomes like you almost become an unpaid consultant for the for that other club, right?
Oh, yeah. And, I didn't know it at the time when I went there, but that's what Scott's program was all about. Like, hey, you're going to come in and be an assistant for 3 or 4 years, and then you're going to go get your own golf course. And so there's a big group of guys that have worked at that club that are now superintendents. And then they all talk, and they all, you know, we all have a group text, and everybody helps each other. And it's a really, and a lot of them have stayed in the DC area, and it's a really good setup.
It's almost like a gang. You're like a gang of superintendents. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a good thing. And then so I was at that club for 4 years, and then that's when I went to TPC Potomac. I went to TPC Potomac in 2009.
What was it like going from a club culture to the tour, which, you know, you're going to essentially, like, it would be like going from, I feel like, almost like a startup or mom pop business to a $1 billion company.
Yeah. I mean, it was really different, but it was great. Like, I really wanted, because we'd had tour events at Royal Melbourne and I loved them. I loved working. When we would have a professional tournament come to Royal Melbourne, it was really exciting. And I really loved that time. And so to be able to go to a golf course that hosted events was huge. And they had the 2010 Senior Players Championship. Marco Mira won. That was the first tournament I worked as a superintendent.
That was the first event back for the course since it was, you know, this much maligned opening where one player just went off on it. Called it like a...
Well, so the old Avenel, I didn't know any... So the golf course was rebuilt in 2007 and 2008. Steve Winsloff, PGA Tour architect, did the redesign. And I never even knew what... I knew I'd heard of Avenel, but I couldn't picture any of the old holes. But Greg Norman gave it a beating. The ninth hole, he said, yeah, that they should drop a bomb on it and blow it up. It was a downhill par three. And in the redesign, they moved the green up on the hill. But Greg Norman ripped him apart, I guess, when he would play there.
It's a bit ironic that he was the one doing the ripping.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I guess the ninth hole in particular. I don't know if something bad happened. Maybe I don't know what happened, but he said they should drop a bomb on it. So I came in right after they had just reopened. I think they'd only been reopened for like 6 months when I started. So yeah, it was really different. I mean, but it was great because I loved pro golf. So working for the PGA Tour was, you know, it was really exciting because you would, you know, you'd hear things about the tour and players. And then it was great because I hosted five events in 10 years I was there. And so I'd love it when Australians would come to play because I would always go and talk to them and say hi to them. And that was always, it was really fun, right? Like I'd try to like turn the course up a little bit like it was back home. And so it was good.
How does maintenance work? Obviously, at a club, you've got your greens chair, you've got your GM, and you've got a management structure and everything. But at the end of the day, you're the expert. I imagine when you're working for TPC Tour, there's a whole corporate structure, and I imagine there's a career path once you're, you know, in it as a superintendent to where you become somebody that oversees a number of superintendents, right? And so as a superintendent, you probably have a lot more checks and balances at the TPC courses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's a whole – so the agronomy team with the PGA Tour, it's kind of split in two. There's a TPC group that kind of oversees TPCs, and then there's a competitions group that oversees tournaments on the three other tours that aren't on TPCs. And so – yeah, I would have an agronomist and he would come and visit the golf course kind of quarterly on average. And so he would inspect the golf course and inspect your maintenance shop, and there was a checklist, and you would kind of work together and try to put together plans of especially how you're going to prepare for tournaments. And so yeah, there's a lot of checks and balances.
Would they just show up unannounced, or you know when they're coming?
No, you'd know.
Oh, that'd be crazy if they just showed up with the checklist.
Yeah, there's a little bit of prep. Your maintenance shop might be a bit dirty and gotten a bit sideways, and so there'd be some cleaning going on before.
It'd almost be better if they just showed up randomly.
That's how they would probably get the truest bit. They're great guys. They would never do that. But no, they would let you know when they're coming.
Did you kind of have like a box that you had to keep the course in where where at the Fazio course you worked at after RTJ, you kind of colored outside the lines. You did some improvisation. I mad it was. Was it much more frowned upon in the tour?
A little. I mean, so, oh yeah. Well, you would have to get several people to sign off on things. I couldn't just go out and change the golf course because I decided that I'm going to widen that fairway by 30 yards and I'm going to rip out all the rough around the green and make short grass all around the green. You couldn't do that, but you could suggest you'd work with your agronomist and the design team, and you would say, hey, in my opinion, I think this hole would be better if we did this. And sometimes they'd say yes, and sometimes they'd say no, but you couldn't go and do it yourself. There was several levels of approval that you had to get. And then that's the same way when you're having a tournament. You have an agronomist that comes in the week before, and you're together every day and you're kind of monitoring the greens and the bunkers, and he, you know, you start working together on what you think you need to work on to get ready for next week. And
yeah, I'm interested in that. How working with the tour for a tournament, obviously you guys had the you had Tigers event for a couple years in a row. What was it like? What's the run up like? And then as a course superintendent, what's the week of and your input levels on pins and week of conditioning for a tournament?
So no input on pins. That's all the rules stuff. So it's a tough balance, right? I mean, TPC Potomac was a busy club. So you're trying to manage member play, but also get ready to have a tournament and make it look like nobody's been there. And our tournament dates were tough because it was July 4th weekend in the middle of the summer. So that was always tough. But the lead up, you know, it was cart path only for a month to keep the carts out of the rough. But you don't have a say on where the pins are going. That's all the rules staff. They'll assign a rules official to do front nine, back nine setup. And those guys get to pick where they want the tee markers and the pins to go on the front and back nine. But you would work together with, you get an advance official who comes in the week before. And so the three of you, your competitions agronomist, your advance official and yourself, you know, you get together and you kind of pick a target stimp, like where you want the stimp to be on the first day. And, you know, hey, let's shoot for 12 and a half and we'll ramp up to 13 or low 13s by Sunday. So that was a tough balance. That was always a tough balance for me because maybe being from Australia and I love golf and I like architecture and I want the course to play a certain way. And so I was always leaning towards really drying it out and trying to put it on the edge a little bit. And I feel like we in 2017 Quicken Loans, I feel like we did well with that.
Yeah, that was the one that only a couple guys were under par, right? It was that Kyle Stanley was in it, and if I remember correctly.
Yep. Francesco Molinari won the last one, but Kyle Stanley won that one. And yep, so 8-1. It was tough that year, but regardless of scores, I just wanted it to play firm and dry and a little bit like it would be back home. But that's a tough balance because, you know, it can look pretty ugly come Sunday when you're doing that, which I didn't care about. I just wanted to put on a good golf tournament. But that's tough for the club because, so Jeff Obie and I had this conversation during the Quicken Loans once because we were really dry and he was loving it. And
yeah, he was in the interview, he talked about it felt like he was playing in Australia. I remember that.
Yeah, I love that. That was great for me. And he said in the paper a bit that week, like, it's good to play on greens that remind me of back home. And so that's what I was kind of going for. But in DC, doing that around July 4th weekend, that's hard to do without it getting pretty ugly. And there's never any, it's not disease and it's not anything like that. It just gets dry and it starts to wilt. And I was telling Jeff, like, it's a tough balance because the club's booked God knows how many corporate outings after the tournament. And, you know, they could sell a corporate Monday outing for $80,000 on the, you know, for one day, or $100,000 or whatever it is for a week or two after the tournament. And now Steven's just gone and put the place on edge and it doesn't look so great. And so what does that do for club revenue? And that's when a club manager would get a little worried and they don't want, so it's that tough balance, right? Of like, you're trying to prepare for a tournament and you want to put it on the edge. And I personally didn't mind how ugly it got because I just wanted it to play good. Mm-hmm. But club management doesn't always want that because how does that affect revenues after the tournament? How does that affect the perception to members that and they haven't played the course for 2 weeks, and now they want to get back out, and it's beat up and whatnot. So that, for every superintendent that hosts an event, that's always a tough balance, right? Especially because half the time when they're playing events, the weather's never, especially when they get on the East Coast, the weather's never right.
Yeah.
It's only the West Coast guys get great weather. The East Coast guys, East Coast superintendents, it's always hard because you got most of them are in the summer and you get summer storms on the East Coast.
I think that next year, the one where Molinari won and Tiger was in it, Zach Blair was in it. I remember that was the infamous one where Tiger was changing shirts every three holes because of how sweaty he was.
Yeah, he said it was the hottest round of golf he ever played. I think the heat index was 115. And here I am mowing the greens four times. Everyone else in the area is babying their greens.
Playing defense.
Hey, I got to mow the greens three or four times and mow the fairways in the evening. And it was hard. And yeah, I got the reins pulled in a little bit on that second one because I pushed it pretty far on the first one. And so on the second one, it was because what you do is they check moisture. So you stimp, you check moisture and you check firmness every morning and every evening, right? And they collect that data and they write it down. And then some greens are wetter than others and some greens are drier than others and some greens stimp quicker than others and whatnot. And me, I would just let it go like the year before. I didn't really mind. But that second one, it was like, well, hey, the fifth green is really dry. I think we need to water that one tonight.
So they kind of have like a box of parameters that they want to keep the course in.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it changes depending on the grasses they're playing on and the area of the country. But they'll pick the week before. They'll say, hey, let's shoot to be here on firmness. You know, let's shoot to be stimping around this number and let's keep the greens at kind of this moisture. So they'll pick those three numbers and they'll try to kind of maintain or maybe even just slightly drop off from those numbers by the end of the week. I didn't really, I always had a, as I got a little older, I still wrestle with that a little bit because I don't know, it seems to me to be okay if one green's softer than the other and one green's firmer than the other, right? Like that would make the course play a little bit differently. It would
ask players to answer different questions rather than the same one over and over again, right?
Yeah.
Might make it a little bit more interesting golf tournament.
Yeah, like it's not their fault. I mean, it's a player-run organization. The players have told them that they want consistency, so I don't blame them one bit. But I just think if you have a green that sits down in a hole, like the 12th at Augusta, right? That green's got to always be softer than the other. The 12th green at Augusta has to be softer than the 18th green at Augusta.
It sits in the shade all day.
Right, yeah. And so like at Royal Melbourne, for example, the third green on the East Course, which is on the composite course, is, at least in my time, was always softer than the sixth green on the West Course that is on the composite course, right? Because the third East green sits way down in a hole. It used to have these huge cypress trees around it, and it was just always a tough green to dry out when I worked there. And I feel like that's okay, right? Like you feel like the caddy should say, hey, this green yesterday was a bit softer and it sits down in a hole and you should play this one closer to the flag because it'll probably stop quicker. And on the other firm greens, you've got to play it shorter and roll it up. But same with the bunkers. Like they want the bunkers to just be all exactly the same. And I don't know. I feel like it would be kind of cooler if they all played a little bit differently.
It's like this pursuit for uniformity and maintenance when, I mean, if you walk around any member of your yard, the grass is going to be different in different areas. Like I've got a giant silver maple. The grass is way different there than on my parkway that has no trees on it. You know, like I can't grow the same grass there. And if I want the same grass, I'm going to have to spend eight times as much time and money to get that.
That's what happens. Yeah. So superintendents are working so hard to get it all playing the same. And in Australia, we just, when I think back, and again, it was the 90s, so it was a different time, but I felt like we just didn't get as hung up on that. Like I put this on Twitter, Mike Clayton and I were going back and forth on Twitter a little while ago, and this same topic came up, and I used the Sixth West at Royal Melbourne as an example, and I don't know about today, but in my time, the front left bunker on the Sixth West at Royal Melbourne was always a boggy bunker. It always felt like it had more sand in it. And if you hit it in that bunker, there was always a really good chance your ball was going to plug, or you were going to have an uphill shot. That bunker's 12 feet deep or whatever, and you're out of really boggy sand. And behind that green on the back left corner, there's this little bunker. And that green was always rock. That bunker was always rock hard. It was like, you know, hitting off of a hard pan, and the green falls away from you there. And it was the hard, like you couldn't pick two more different bunker shots on one hole, the front left bunker and the back left bunker. And I always remember thinking that, like, we would get to play at Royal Melbourne as employees, and you kind of knew when you were in the middle of that fairway, you just knew in your head, like, geez, if I hit it short in the front left one, it's probably going to plug. And if I hit it in the back one, that's the hardest up and down in the world. I'm never going to get up and down. And you just knew. And that was okay. Like, but it doesn't seem to be that way anymore. Like, no matter what bunker you hit in, it's going to be the exact same.
It stinks, too. I always say that the why golf is the coolest game is because no matter what, you'll never, ever be in the same exact position twice in your life. Like, you could play golf every single day, all day long, for the rest of your life. You'll never hit the exact same shot twice because you'll never have the same lie, the same exact wind to the same pin from the exact same yardage, right? And that something that adds to that is having to, like, getting in the sand and feeling in your feet and knowing intrinsically. It almost rewards the experienced player that can analyze all that stuff, and in a way the uniformity kind of dumbs down the game.
Oh yeah, I mean, so you wrote a good article, I think it was last week, about the rough, right? Thick rough versus low rough, and whether you're going to get a flyer and how much more unpredictable that is than thick rough. And I agree with that. I remember we had a tournament once at TPC and the rough was really thick, and I remember Mark Russell said, we got to mow the rough Friday night because it's going to be too thick come Sunday. And again, me being, you know, superintendents are always protective of their golf course. And Mark Russell, he's a brilliant golf mind. Like, that guy, he's really, really smart. And I remember saying to him, like, don't worry about it. Like, I think it'll be fine on Sunday. I really don't think we need to mow the rough. And he explained that. That was the first time I'd ever heard someone explain it to me that way. He said, listen, if you have the rough lower and they don't know whether the ball is going to fly out or how it's going to come out, it's going to be so much harder for them. And I never had thought of it that way. And he was the first one that explained it that way. And he was right. He's dead right. So, you know, it's funny, like, everybody's talking these days about how to set courses up and scoring. And you just wonder, like, is that something, you know, if it was a little more irregular, would that make the, that would, you know, that would change it up, right?
The most irregular championship's the Open, and look what it does every year. You know, like that you hit it in the rough there, you have no clue what's going to happen to the ball when it comes out. It could look like you're the easiest lie in the world and shoot 60 yards left. And
yeah,
I think that, and then I think the best part about it is what Russell alluded to is, like, you have a couple, though, you misjudge a couple of those, and that's going to be in the guy's head. And that's the best place to be with a tour player. You got it. The only way you can challenge them is to make it feel like it's not a driving range, you know?
Totally. Like, I remember a podcast you did with Jeff once, and you talked about, maybe it was when you were younger or in Melbourne, and you hit a drive and it would go in the rough. And that anticipation or that excitement, especially when you were young and you're playing in a club event, and as you're walking up down the fairway and you're walking up to the ball, you're kind of like, oh, please be sitting good. Please be good.
Yeah.
And that anticipation or that excitement of getting to it, and it happens to be sitting up, and you're like, yes, I can go at this now. If it's a par five, maybe you could hit three wood and get there, or it's not sitting very good and wedge out. And I remember he said, you know, that's all gone now, because you're walking down a fairway and you know exactly how it's going to be lying. And it's easier to get those irregular roughs and those irregular lies when you're on sand too. And the golf course is on sand, the rough's going to be a little like pine, like it is down at Pinehurst or places. It's easier to get that when you're on sand. It's hard, like up here, when you're on clay and it rains 40 inches a year and grass grows kind of nonstop, it is harder to get that irregular rough a little bit, right?
It seems like you could, with that, if you didn't chase, you know, that consistency, it seems like that, not knowing exactly, but for a superintendent, that's, you're constantly chasing your tail for that consistency, and it probably costs a ton of money, and it might, you know, it might, this would be something that a lot of members would argue about, but it might cheapen the experience of golf, and then it also comes at an extreme resource, time, and money cost.
Yeah, because I've hosted tournaments before where we would, you know, we might be double cutting and rolling the greens, right? And we'd stimp a green, and for whatever reason, it's 4 inches slower than the green before. So we'd give it an extra roll, you know, to try to get it to catch up. I don't know. As my time went on, as I got older, I remember just becoming a little more disillusioned with that and thinking, geez, like, it's okay that they're a little bit different.
It could too be like if you stimp it in one spot, that's just subtly uphill, right? Like you just stimp it in one place, you could stimp differently in another place. It's grass, right? It's growing. It could be different within a green.
Or you wish you could say, hey, those two greens over there are really slow. Why don't you get nuts with the pin position on those couple? Because they're really slow. But Dean Beeman, he used to play at TPC Potomac quite a bit. And I would always go out and kind of ride a hole with him and chat with him. And he's a huge proponent of slow greens. He used to even, and the greens were never overly fast for member play, but he always used to say to me, like, the greens are too fast, they're too perfect, it's easy to hole putts out here. And why don't you slow them down and put the pins? He was a big one for that. He used to, well, I bet he still does. He always thought the greens were too fast and the putting would be so much harder if the greens were slow. And he was a huge pro. He hated the fact that the green speeds had gotten to where they were.
I think he gets a lot of credit, but I still think he doesn't get enough credit for all the stuff he did and like his general thoughts on a lot of things. Like, I mean, that guy, one of the most brilliant minds golf's ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting guy. He hated thick rough and he hated fast greens, at least when he always plays his wife, Judy, and he'd say, rough's too thick for my wife and it's no fun to play out of. And the greens are too fast when you get up on the green. And yeah.
Being somebody that loves architecture, talk about, I know, I don't think anybody would put TPC Potomac in like a masterclass of architecture mold. What was it like working at a golf course that doesn't really get your juices flowing from an architecture standpoint?
It's a catch 22, right? Like I think about it a bit, like if you did work somewhere that is a brilliant design architecturally, a lot of the times those places don't want to change anything, right? They're like, hey, this is kind of the holy grail. Just mow the grass, keep the grass alive, rake the bunkers. We like it the way it is. And rightfully so on some of the best designs in the country. But as a superintendent, most superintendents are always want to tinker and tweak with their golf course. So don't get me wrong, it'd be great to work on some of those great designs, but at the same time, I think you do want a little bit of freedom to play around with them a little bit and within reason, right?
Yeah, because if you're at one of the great, great spots, your job, you're a caretaker more so than if you're at somewhere where, the pedigree is a little bit less and you've got a little bit more freedom.
Right. I mean, the funnest jobs would be the guys that take over from somewhere that was great a long time ago and they've got good maps and good aerials. And then they've got a bit of a freedom to say to the club, hey, why don't, you know, this is how this hole used to be 80 years ago and the fairway was this wide and these trees were out over here. And, you know, if you're okay with it, I'm going to take those trees down and I'm going to rip that rough up and I'm going to make the fairway wider and I can do all that in-house. And that would be a lot of fun, right? Those, I mean, sometimes those are the funnest, and we all know people that have gotten jobs like that and got to tinker with their courses. And sometimes those would be the funnest ones around to be able to look at what you've done. I mean, like Curtis at Old Elm, right? That's one that comes to mind. I mean, I was there last year and it's, you know, he did so much of that, sounds like in-house, and I don't know the exact process they used, but how much fun that must have been and how proud you can be to look at it today at like what they've done. And, you know, that a lot of it was him, right? So those, but the problem is there's not many of those left because lots of them are being restored, thankfully. And so there's not many of those left these days to stumble upon.
Yeah. You know, Brian Palmer, the old superintendent at Shore Acres, I spent some time in his office and he had their old, I can't remember exactly what year it was, maybe 29 aerial blown up huge. I mean, it was the entire wall right in front of his desk and he would just stare at it every day. And they got everything almost back. And I remember I was in there and he would just look at the one spot, the one or two spots that wasn't exactly. And he would be like, that's next. That's that. Yeah. And that's like, it like encompassed his life for, you know, 5-6 years.
Yeah. Didn't they overlay? I think I heard a story. Didn't they overlay the plan on like a Google Earth map or something? And it was almost spot on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody told me that. But
yeah. And there was one spot where he didn't do it exactly. And he was like, you know, really screwed that one up. you could tell he just was really upset about it.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, that must be so much fun to get. To get something like that, right? There's not many of them left. I mean,
there's plenty. Believe me, there are more than people realize.
You would know.
There's some that have been restored that you go out to and you're like, you know, you didn't restore it. The line's 20 yards off. Like, why? You know, the bunker's in the, you know, doesn't cut all the way in, and you can just see it because you can see the landform. That's one of my pet peeves is when you see a great fairway landform and then the fairway line is right on the middle of it and you're like, and it's been restored and you're like, how did you not see the left half of that land feature that was clearly the fairway? You know, these old architects didn't drape fairways over land features and then put rough on half of it. You know, they wanted the ball to roll off it.
I agree. Yeah, you would know. You've seen. You'd probably have a list of the ones that are still available to fix. But
one of my favorite conversations I've ever had with you is centers around, I guess I would call them knickknacks around golf courses.
Oh yeah,
your pet peeve.
Yeah, like the furniture and stuff like that. Yeah, it gets crazy, right? There's companies out there that sell rubbish bins for $2,000 and stuff like that. I mean, I've done it. I've bought them. I mean, if you're at a club that I've worked at clubs in the past where that was kind of what they wanted and that's what you do. But yeah, it's funny how I always think of that. Like, so back in Melbourne, they have a lot of the old Sandbelt courses had these tee boxes, these steel tee boxes. They're not really, I don't think you'd really use them for anything now, but they were for back in the day, they were a rubbish bin, or I think they even might have put sand in them when they were before tees, right? And they were using sand to tee off of them. Those things were great. They look, Kingston Heath still has them. They look beautiful. But yeah, over here, they love some furniture over here. But some past clubs I've worked at, they want a lot of furniture. I mean, luckily, most places I've been able to convince them to go back the other way, and it's been met favorably. And but yeah, there's some places you go to where it's everywhere. But yeah, you and I have visited some golf courses where get a couple of holes in and
well, yeah, you look at it and you think, God, they just spent $20,000 on something that they didn't need to spend $20,000. And then you go in like the best spots, like the coolest places.
Yeah.
Have this like homemade stuff, and like it's completely authentic and unique to them. And that's the thing that it's like, it happens where they think, oh, we're dressing up the place. But really what you're doing is you're making it more tacky. And if you just went out and handmade something, cut down a tree and just chopped up some blocks from the course, you'd make the golf course better. And you'd make the whole experience more unique like that. I think that's like an underrated part. And I don't know, you know, where it falls, because I'm sure there's like a golf committee or some committee at a club that I don't even know, you know, what the title of is that dresses these things up. But at the same time, it almost should be in the hands of the superintendent, because what it would do is it would create a unique feel, and it would become, it's almost like a culture thing for the club.
Yeah. There's definitely a movement back to it, right? Guys making their own benches out of logs cut in half and making their own tee markers. And there's definitely a movement back to that, but yeah, you're right. Like the best clubs in the country, they almost don't have anything.
Yeah.
Down on Long Island, or clubs in Philadelphia, New Jersey. I mean, I remember going to one of the best clubs in the country once, and their scorecard box on like the second tee. So if you forgot to get a scorecard when you tee it off, get another one. It was just in a mailbox. I think this is what you're talking about. And I said to you, if that was at some clubs I've worked at in the past, we'd have bought a $2,000 scorecard box, you know, polished hardwood, looking beautiful. But here's one of the best courses in the country, and they've just got an old mailbox with the scorecards in it. It's perfect.
And I went to that GIS show this year. I'm walking around, and I'm seeing all these things. I'm like, who goes there and buys this stuff? Like, you could, there's so many things. It's like, I don't know. There's the same thing going on in golf. It's like, you know, people buy $60 alignment aids that are just wood sticks that are, you know, like, it's like,
you and I have walked around the GIS show that you started almost hyperventilating walking past some of those furniture stores.
Well, it's like these are the same clubs that'll say, oh, we don't have money to fix the golf course. And it's like, you just spent $25,000 on useless shit for around the golf course. You could spend that, and you could expand a green for that much money.
It happens, right? Yeah, it has happened. I mean, but you hope that's where you get the right people in place, and you can – if you sell your vision well enough and you kind of explain it well enough, most places will be open to, most places get it. There's definitely a movement back to that. I think a lot of places are starting to go away from that. Than where it was maybe 20 years ago.
It'll be cool. I mean, like, I think the more golf can pull on its history, and obviously there are courses that don't have that history, but you know, make something, you know, make something yours, because if you make something, then it's yours. Nobody else has that.
Well, COVID's probably helped that out a little bit, right? Because a lot of golf courses had to pull everything off the golf course.
That's true.
And maybe some places now realize that, well, geez, you know, if you've taken the ball washers off the golf course, maybe people are like, well, do you really miss them? Or maybe you don't need them, right? COVID's probably one of the worst things that could have happened to some of those companies that make furniture, right?
Because ball washer is maybe the thing that bugs me the most. And here's the other thing with the benches and stuff. Nothing's better than just going and sitting down under a tree. That's the best thing to do. Find some shade and sitting down on the ground.
Yeah. Well, you'd hope pace of play is good enough that you don't really...
You haven't been to a public golf course on a weekend in a while, Stephen.
Right, yeah. But I mean, yeah. It's funny. I know, like, a lot of superintendents I talk to, that's a bit of the talk right now, right? COVID has, a lot of clubs have removed bunker rakes and ball washers, and all the knickknacks. And some clubs are kind of realizing that, well, geez, maybe we didn't need all that. And so there's a lot of superintendents I talk to. That's what they're all talking about right now, is whether they can at least reduce some of it, or whether some of it even needs to go back at all.
What are some things on the maintenance, on like the turf side, that you've learned from COVID and restrictions and, you know, less staff, I imagine? And
I mean, I think everybody's trying to do the same with less, right? It seems like play is up at most clubs, and which is a great thing. So on the turf side, I mean, there's only so much you can change. I'm trying to think. That's a hard one. I mean, we've definitely changed the way we mow some stuff and trying to figure out different ways to do things. But from the biggest impact, I think, is that what we were just talking about, the knick-knack thing. That seems to be the biggest. That seems to be the one that everybody's talking about. The guys that I talk to, that seems to be the biggest thing that everybody's talking about.
All found money. Yeah, my book. All the golf course accessory companies are going to come after me now.
Yeah. You're going to have to plot the way you walk around the GIS show next time. You're going to plot your way around.
Yeah. Hey, it's been fun. You're on Twitter. You're on Instagram. Big History and Architecture. I recommend following Steven. He brings a lot to the social media world too.
It's been great, and thank you, Andy. You do a great job, and I've been listening for a long time, back to when you and I first met at Belmont. That was a fun day.
That was a place where lots of money mismanagement there, those brand new cart paths, and then crying poor.
That was a good couple of days. But thank you for everything you do, and you and I have talked about this before. Many a road trip listening to the pods has got me through many a road trip. So great job. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I'm glad we got to do this. It's always fun talking. So we'll talk soon, and thank you.
Definitely.